Welcome to Master the Start, a podcast for young professionals where we interview business experts on how you can master the start of your life in business.
What's up, everyone? This is the bonus footage from Paul Eisenberg. Remember, Master the Start podcast. What do? We give college students and other young professionals a means of learning business and life lessons from experts from around the world. You're going to get some bonus content today, which is awesome because it gives you exclusive access to CEOs, executives, professional athletes, and many more VIPs. Obviously, we won't be hitting the five major questions in this episode, but what we are going to learn about is Paul's unique experience, and he is going to go more in depth on his experience and the adventure that he went through when his wife died. He'll talk more in depth about how he runs a nonprofit and many more awesome things. So listen to the bonus content. It's well worth it. This is where all the juicy content is, and we'll talk to you after the show. You're doing this nonprofit thing, and it's amazing, number one.
Thank you.
My team and one of the guys that actually runs this podcast with me, we started a nonprofit as well down at the Mayo Clinic for
families.
What's
his name?
Michael. That's my brother.
Hey, Michael.
Yeah. So we started a nonprofit for families, battling cancer at the Mayo Clinic.
That's awesome. So
I don't know if you want me to bring this up or not, but you've had the experience.
Bring anything up you want, buddy.
All right. So you've dealt with cancer personally, your wife, correct?
Yep.
And for us that have dealt with that, we have an understanding, I believe, of how short life is.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe a lot of us have a choice to live differently after experiencing that. Mm-hmm. And you can see it in your story. But how do we help people understand how significant life is without them actually going through that experience?
So that's a lot, right? It might help to reset for a minute. Let me kind of give you the 2-minute drill on bringing hope home for everybody's benefit and to kind of reset the conversation. Then I'll answer that.
Please
so
do.
If I don't answer, don't call me up. Call me out on it. So we started because, as you mentioned, my late wife, Nicole, who I met at college, took me 4 years to get a date, persistent. And I got her to date me. I got her to marry me. That was the best. That was probably the crowning achievement of my life. We had two children. And when she was pregnant with our second child, Gabby, she wasn't gaining weight. She wasn't feeling good. She was tired. And we explained it all away. But what we didn't know is she's 9 months pregnant. She had stage 4 Hodgkin's disease. So, which obviously put us on our heels, and she gave birth to Gabby, went right into treatment, 6.5 years of treatment between University of Pennsylvania and NIH in Bethesda, tons of chemo, tons of radiation, and 2 bone marrow transplants, and sadly passed away August 2nd, 2003 at home. And during that time, we focused on, it's going to sound counterintuitive, we focused on how lucky we were. We had family that loved us and helped us and supported us. We had friends from the neighborhood, from church, from school that helped us and loved us and supported us. I had flexibility in jobs. I made a good enough living to be with her on our treatments. We had people to watch the kids. I was a sales guy. I always made my number. So I made my number so I didn't have to worry about my job. And then when you're in these settings of chemo and transplant and hospitals, you meet people that you get to know immediately, very deeply, very closely. And there were so many people that had nothing. You talked about not having a sense of community. They didn't have, you know, they were picking between food and heat. They had a car problem that they couldn't afford to get fixed. If they couldn't get it fixed, they couldn't go to work. They lost their benefits. They had these real problems. And God love Nicole. You can go to our website at bringinghopehome.org. She was 5 foot nothing. And she's like, that's not right. We got to do something. And whenever she said, we got to do something, it meant me. So I was complaining that I hadn't seen my friends. So I would come home and say, hey, you know, I saw Bobby today. I haven't seen Bobby forever. He's such a great guy. And I would say that about everybody, men and women. And Nicole's like, yeah, I'm really kind of tired of hearing you complain. So why don't you do an event, invite your network, and raise money for a charity? I said, that's a good idea. So I called my buddy Timmy, and we started doing the Great Guy Dinner, men and women. We only invite people we like, and we raise money. And it's really that simple, but it's a great night. It's a lot of energy. First year we did it in 01, we had 100 guys, men and women, raised $13,000 for the American Cancer Society. We did that for 8 years. We raised about $500,000. We didn't want to do anything. We didn't want any payroll, fiduciary. I didn't want to run a business like that. I just wanted to have an event and see my friends. So then between year 7 and 8, we lost one of our guys, passed away. We heard his wife was struggling. Went to one of our donors and said, every year you give us $5,000 to the ACS, American Cancer Society, this year. Give them three, write a $3,000 check. Give the two cash to us, and together we'll give it to this family. They're struggling. It's only $2,000, right? It's a lot of money, but it's not in a grand scheme of things. The impact that $2,000 had on that family was an epiphany to Timmy and I. It was like, yeah, $2,000, but this family acted honestly and sincerely like it was a bag of gold. And what I began to realize was, yeah, it was the money, but more importantly, it was somebody cares about us. We are in the hurt locker. We lost our loved one, and we don't see a lot of brightness right now. But somebody cares enough to reach out to do something for us that we didn't even ask for, that we can never repay, that they don't want us to repay. So that's how we got involved. And we started doing some research, and we discovered that we've confirmed this with a couple different articles. And there's this financial toxicity out there that the cost of, because they're, thank God for medical research, because they're keeping people alive longer, but at what cost? Some people,
you're good.
Some people can't afford to keep working at the same pace they were. If they're going to treatment, they're not able to work the same pace, the same job. So they're not making as much, maybe, or they have this great cost of medication. So the out-of-pocket cost for a family during a cancer treatment could be $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. So we looked at that and we're like, well, I've tried to figure out medical bills. Nicole was sick for 6.5 years, and I still don't understand medical bills. And so we said, why don't we pay rent, mortgage, utilities, car payment, food, any type of person, any type of cancer. They just have to be in our area in treatment. There's no financial means testing. They don't have to be X number of percentage near or below or above the poverty line. I don't really, that's not material to us. Do you have cancer? Are you in our area? Do you need help? We don't give the family money. We raise the money through events and our fundraising. And the families get nominated to us by the social worker at the hospital. We're in about 100 hospitals in 6 states. And if the social worker says that they're in treatment, they're in treatment. And we get the bills from the family. We pay the bills directly. The family never touches the money, or we'll give gift cards to grocery stores. That's the closest thing we do. And Christmas presents at Christmas time, backpacks at back to school time. We have different events throughout the year for families to be a part of, our 5Ks. We have a fashion show this Friday, and I think we have 26 or 28 models, and I think 15 or 16 are families that we've helped. We have a family reunion with the Philadelphia Phillies, and we have 500-plus families come, and they get lunch, a T-shirt, and tickets, and we go watch the game and have a good time. And we don't help patients. They are our families. You want to talk about a sense of community? They're our families. You're not allowed to use that P word in here. It's a dollar, because they're our families. We treat them like their families. We act like their families. We're crazy enough with them because they're like our families. And we have been blessed with so many wonderful people. So that's the backdrop to who we are and what we do and why we do it. I got a staff of 6 full-time, 2 part-time, and a army of volunteers and wonderful contractors. So your question was, how do we get people to appreciate the quality and value of life from a perspective of going through junk? Everybody's going through junk, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody. Some really, really bad junk. Some, still junk. And I don't know the answer to that question, to be honest and candid. I think that I don't think you can make anybody do anything they don't want to do. You can get them to follow an act. Like, I can sit here and talk to my team and threaten them, and they might do what I want them to do at the time, but then I lose them. Like, yeah, you don't have kids, do you?
Not yet.
You're too young and well-rested to have children. But like, as a parent, you can yell at your kid, or if you own a dog, you can yell at your dog. Eventually, they tune it out. So I think that for us, how we get people to come on board with us and get connected to us is we just present them with the opportunity. So whenever I'm meeting with a prospective donor, that's one of my main functions here, is raising money. So, you know, you've heard the term, we kill what we eat, or we eat what we kill. We can only help people if people give us money. That's the simple and God's honest truth. Is if somebody doesn't want to write us a check, it's a tough up, bro. We can't really help anybody. It's helping families is our number one priority. Raising money is like 1A, because nothing happens until somebody raises money. So we have very candid and honest conversations with people. We're like, you know what, Bobby? It's great to meet you at lunch, and I'm great to be on your podcast, but I'm going to ask you for money today. And it's your money. So if you want to give us $1 million, thrilled. If you want to give us $1, thrilled. If you don't want to give us anything because we don't connect or you don't connect with us, that's okay too. That's fine, because it's your money. But let me tell you why I think we are a great group to get involved with. Here's how we help families. Within 2 weeks, that money can be deployed to a family that you'll get to hear about. You can deliver Christmas presents to the family that you adopted. You can see them, not some organization that screens and here you go. Here's the address. Here's the Christmas list. Go buy them. Go get them. You don't need a middleman in a charity. So I really tell my team, it is our job to make it easy for people to be involved with us. That is our job. We want to help people, but you know, we have donors that give us a lot of money, and we're thankful and appreciative. We have donors that do unbelievable works for our families because they're craftsmen, or they built our family intake form to make it easier for social workers to nominate, or we have volunteers that show up and answer phones for us. They're all valuable. How do you want to give? How do you want to be involved? So I think, how do you get people to appreciate what they have? I think you give them the opportunity to see what others have or what they don't have, and an opportunity to get involved to make it better. That's what I think.
That's a very good answer. I think it's very accurate.
Well, I can't make you and your brother go be good to people in the Mayo Clinic.
No.
Like, I can't find you on the street and go, hey, what are you doing? 3 to 4 tomorrow. You need to show up I don't need to do anything. So, but you know, I told my kids when we lost our wife, the kids were little, they were 8 and 6. And as they got a little bit older, they were really feeling that pain. And I would hear comments like, well, you know, Jimmy doesn't have any problems in his life. Why doesn't Jimmy have problems? I'm like, man, you don't know what Jimmy goes home to. You don't know what Sally goes home to. They could go home to a house of addiction. They could go home to a house with no money. They could go home to a house of abuse. We got our junk, and it sucks. I mean, it sucked to lose my wife. She was it for me. I thought I couldn't even imagine, but that's not my plan. Those things happen above my pay grade. Someday I'll understand it. God will tell me, but my job is to hang on and figure it out.
Okay. I mean, I agree. We don't have a lot of control, and we have to give that control to a higher power when we're going through something like that. But what advice then?
Did I answer your question?
Yeah, you did. You really did.
Okay. Okay.
What advice would you give to other nonprofits in the sense that you look at a lot of nonprofits nowadays, and I think a lot of them forget that they're running a business in the sense that you need to do things and be very business oriented and have that mindset to really become a successful nonprofit. And how, on top of that, how do you display it to your donors? Because I know we've always run into things when if you use money from donors and you're throwing that towards marketing or something like that, your donors will sometimes question, hey, that's not where I wanted my money to go. But it's the explanation of, here's the deal. If you give me $100 in this specific scenario and I use it to go raise $1,000, like your $100 is doing so much for the world. But it's hard, I think, for a lot of nonprofits to understand stuff like that. And I'm just curious about your take on really what nonprofits could focus on to do a better job.
Well, I think number one, your comment about running it like a business, I really connect with. I am most involved with different business organizations and thoughtful discussions with other people, and none of them are nonprofits. And I learned so much from them. They're all commercial painters, manufacturers, HVACs, caterers, drug companies. Like, I talk to business leaders all the time. I'm like, hey, I got this problem. Hey, this is my situation. Hey, how should I expand? This is what, and the only difference, in my opinion, that between a for-profit company and a not-for-profit company, besides one pays taxes, right? So 501c3, we're a 501c3. We don't pay taxes. And we have to run ourselves by law along the lines of our charter and our purpose. So I can't go out and start, you know, paying for trucks to drive around because that's not what we do. So I think the only difference between a nonprofit and a for-profit is what you do with the money. I don't really think there's any other differences. I think it's in some cases harder to run a nonprofit because you have to maintain certain guidelines and certain parameters around how much you're giving to your mission and your overhead and all these kind of other things. But, you know, my friends who run for-profit companies, if they want to go hire six people and take a loss, they can do that. I can't really do that. So I don't think there's any difference. And I think in the nonprofit community in the Philadelphia area where we're based, we help families in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, up through Pittsburgh, northern New Jersey, southern New Jersey, all of New Jersey, I guess now, southern New York, southern Connecticut, and Baltimore area. We have to figure out how to grow without going bankrupt and not help. So we have to keep helping families. So if you look in the Philly area, like I said, where we are, there's about 50,000 nonprofits. I just went to a seminar about a year ago, and I think of that number, I could be off on this, like less than almost 70% of them are barely hanging on, right? So I don't presume to tell other nonprofits what to do, right? Again, when you get married or have kids, you don't tell anybody what to do. But what I would suggest to people is you have to look at today. Where are we today? Have we built up a reserve? Like, we just spent the last year, this 2018, which we're getting ready to end here at the end of the year, we've made a conscious effort to build up our reserve because there's an economic correction coming somewhere down the road, right? It's just going to happen. Hopefully, God willing, not too bad. But we have to have reserves built up so we can keep helping families, we can maintain our employees, we can continue working. So our ratio is going to be less this year because we've taken this conscious step. So how do you go and talk to donors is, I think you have to pick the right donor for certain messages. So if I have an elderly couple on a fixed income and they're giving us $10 a month, I'm not using their $10 a month to build a reserve. I'm helping families with that money, but I'm having an honest conversation with them. But if I have, like I was with a very successful businessman this morning and we were talking about this and I said, you know, one of our big things is we built our reserve up. He's like, well, what'd you build it up to and why? And what are you going to do? And what's your future? So I told him, he had some suggestions. And then I asked him for a significant amount of money for the reserve. I was honest. I was transparent. And he agreed with most of what I said, but had some really valuable insight. And we'll look at that. So he's writing a check for that amount of money for a reserve because I had to be honest. So my advice to other nonprofits, that's a really broad topic, right? I could talk to you for 3 hours on this topic alone. Mm-hmm. I think you need to build your board of directors with business people that are better and more talented and have different skill sets than you. So I talked earlier about my retired public CFO. He is smarter, better, different, great. And I listen to him. I lean on him for a lot. I have another board member who's a president of a company and is an engineer. Better, smarter, different, great. I have a couple of business development guys that are different in business development than I am. Better, smarter, different, great. I have a private equity guy, and guys are men and women to me. I have a senior manager, sales manager of a healthcare company. I don't have me on the board. I don't need another me. So go outside your comfort zone as a nonprofit leader. Be honest with yourself about where you're weak and where you're strong and fill in your gaps with people that are way better than you. The old joke is if I'm the smartest guy in that room, I don't want to be in that room. I want to be somewhere else. So that's number one. Number two is if you run it like a business and if you track and to me that means you track and measure everything, you constantly work your processes into efficiencies, which we're getting better, but it's a never-ending battle. How do we get the most out of our people without killing them at the least amount of money so we have more money to give to families? How do you get contractors involved so you don't have to pay for the employee costs? You got to look at all those things. That board helps with that. So when you run it like a business, it doesn't mean that you're not a nonprofit or you don't care. It just means that there's certain things you have to do in a way that makes sense, dollars and cents, and makes sense in common sense. Like you have to be able to talk about a decision as to why you move from one contractor to the other. The other contractor's charging you almost over triple what the original contractor was calling, but they're going to get more done in less time. So you're actually saving $9,000. $9,000 is real money. $9,000 is almost nine families. We look at all of our decisions, not just in money, but in families. So if somebody gives us $20,000, they're helping 20,000 or 20 families. That's how we do it. So you got to get a strategic plan, which is not like get a strategic plan. It's work. It's months of work. It's a professional facilitator. Then you got to track it and live it and run it and work on it and change it and talk about it. You got to manage it every day. And then your second part of your question was with donors. How do you go to a donor and say, look, I think if you give me $10,000 for marketing, I can turn it into $100,000. I think you got to go find the right donor and say, if you give me $10,000, I want to show you the plan that I think it'll make us 100. And here's how I'm going to track it. And here's how I'm going to report it to you. And here's what it's going to mean to us as an organization. And then actually go and do it. Then that guy or that lady is going to give you $20,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 because they believe in it. And if you screw up, guess what? Bobby, I screwed up. This is where I screwed up. We're not asking you for any more money, but we're fixing this. But the other side, we had one donor, big corporation, gave us $50,000 a year. Big money. That's big money to us. And by the way, our donors range from $1 to $155,000. $175,000 is our biggest donor. They're not big donors. A lot in that 10, 20, 30, 50, and then a lot of other donors. But they said, what else do you need? I said, I need more money. You know, we can't give you any more money. I go, well, let me flip the question. What can you give me that's easy to get for you? They go, we can pay for a person. I said, let me get this straight. You can give me money. You can't give me any more money, but you can give me money to pay for a person. Exactly. And give you capacity grant. So, all right. What's that mean? And they go, what do you need? I go, I need a development guy because I'm doing it all by myself. So he goes, write up for me what that job is, how much you need for a year and a half, and when in that year and a half will that guy pay for himself? And in this case, it was a man, so it's a guy. So we put together like a 4-page proposal, got a year and a half salary. He paid for himself in 14 months, 16 months. And now, because we got that grant to get that person, and he paid for himself, he's already built a revenue stream that now he's impacted our organization in so many positive ways. Plus, he's a great guy. Plus, he fits like our family, right? So because we run ourselves like a business, and because that's my background, and by the way, I'm not a great businessman, I'm just figuring it out, we were able to get a capacity grant to hire somebody who paid for himself and then continued to add on every year. Because if you don't have 3 times your salary that you return to the business here in this organization, you're gone. And it's not because I'm a jerk. It's just, and it's on me too. If I don't pay myself, if I don't pay for myself 3 times over, I'm out. Everybody has to figure out. We track and see how everybody covers their number. So everybody's a 3 times. Did you get 3 times the amount of revenue that you get paid to help families with cancer? If you didn't, are you in the wrong job? Are we not supporting you the right way? What do we need to do? So that's a really long answer, but looking at it like a business, some of these nonprofits that I interact with, they're like, well, I feel really good about what we do. And, you know, and I'm like, it's great that you feel good. And I feel good. I love my job. But that's not the end all be all. Your job is not to show up to work and feel good about the return that you make. Your job for work is to show up to people that can't help themselves or in a bad way. So how are you going to do that? How are you going to make their life better because you guys exist? And you got to put some really hard numbers and have some really shitty conversations. Excuse me, like, that's some really tough conversations over that. You know, that's not fun, but that's your job. Your job is to take care of these kids. Build a community. Mayo Clinic's a huge facility, a wonderful facility. Your job is to make their day better. How do you know if you made their day better? Did you ask them? Did you send out a survey? I'm not saying you personally, yeah. But you know, how do you know if that program works? How do you know that that art program works? It's one thing to have Mary and Bobby paint a picture, and I'm not picking on art. I love art, but how's it work? Like, how is their day better because you existed? Because that's what donors want to see. And that's what we try to show them. And again, we are far from perfect. So does that answer your question?
It completely does.
Okay.
And I see we only have a couple more minutes, so I'm going to...
Okay, like I said, I got time.
So I got another follow-up based on what you were just saying, because I think it'd be valuable for both for-profit and not-for-profit businesses. How exactly do you measure your employees and yourself in a way that you're making sure each of them are doing 3 times? I mean, because not everyone has a sales position, I'm assuming.
Correct.
So correct. How do you measure that kind of stuff?
So a lot of that depends on your business, right? So with us, we have myself, so I'm easy to measure because I'm in development, director of development, development coordinator, and we have a school program person. That's all money in, revenue in. So that's easy. Event planner. Event planner is what was your expenses and the ratio. We track and measure the ratio between expenses and revenue. So we try to keep everything below 15% on event expenses. But then we look at how many participants, how much on average per participant, how much total, those kind of things. And every event's different. Like it's, we track a golf outing differently. We track a 5K, then we track a big dinner. So it all depends. Marketing, we track, that's a little bit tougher, but we track, we try to tie it into events and click throughs and like we're going to have a Giving Tuesday social media campaign. So we'll be able to track that. It depends. And then lastly, as our family department, we track, I'm trying to think of a better term for it, but it's not ROI. But what we do is instead of just paying a bill, we will negotiate with the bill collector. So if somebody owes rent and they're a month late on rent, we call the landlord up. My family office calls the landlord up and says, we know they're a month late. They're in a tough situation. If you waive the penalties and give us a month, we'll ship FedEx the check to you today for 2 months. So in essence, you're getting 3 months out of two. We look at that ratio and we're able to bring that together. We'll call a utility up and get them to waive penalties, late fees, put them in a budgeting program, knock some of that money off. Not all bills will do that. And then the other thing that we do is instead of just paying bills all the time, we'll do bills. But if somebody has a project, like right now we have a family who they have a big hole in their roof. They got a significantly ill family member. We're trying to figure out, we can pay X number towards this roof to get repaired, which is in the $10,000 to $15,000 range. Is there another charity we can collaborate with that'll pay some? Is there something we can get from the vendor that we pay for the product, the materials, and he gives the labor as a donation? How can we work it? And we track all that. So it really depends on your business and your people, but that's how we do it. And that's very high simplicity. So
yeah, cool. That's really cool. Well, I think I could probably talk to you forever.
Yeah, call me anytime. Please.
I will. I definitely will. And I was really looking forward to this thing. And
me too,
Bob. You did not disappoint.
Oh, thanks, man. It was great to meet you. And I really appreciate you laying out what you guys do with the Mayo. And you never know. Maybe we'll get to work together someday.
You never know.
World domination.
It's been a treat.
Me too.
Thank you very much.
Very much. Happy Halloween and call me anytime.
All right. Will do. Bye.
All right. Thanks. See you.
Welcome back. I hope you love that bonus content as much as I did. I thought it was great. He really went in depth and was an open book for all of us to learn more about him and his organization. Thank you so much, Paul, for being on the show. Also, big thanks to all of you for listening this week. So do me a couple favors, please. Number one, actually most importantly, number one, go to Paul Eisenberg's website, Bringing Hope Home. You can find that at www.bringinghopehome.org. Check out what he does, and if you really feel compelled and moved by his message, maybe donate something today. It'd be super helpful for those people battling cancer. I know this is very close to my heart, and I think you can really make a big difference with no matter how much money you donate. It could be a dollar, it could be five, it could be $100. But go to the site, check it out. He'd really appreciate it. And more importantly, those families would really, really appreciate it. Number two, make sure you go to iTunes, Google Play, or whatever it might be, and leave us a review. Hopefully it's a good one, but leave us a review. We'd really appreciate it. Thank you once again for being here this week, and we will see you or talk to you next week.